and welcome to the Houston Innovators Podcast. I'm Natalie Harms, editor of Innovation Map. My guest for today is Dr. Kimon Angelides, executive chairman and CEO of FemTech Health, a Houston-founded company that's created a comprehensive solution for women's health, from beauty and lifestyle to fertility and hormonal analytics. Kimon joins the show to discuss how he's created a career as a serial entrepreneur and where the FemTech industry as a whole, as well as Houston's innovation ecosystem, is headed. Hi, Kimon. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Hey, thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it, Natalie.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you about several things, but let's start with just some background on you. You are a serial entrepreneur, right? So is this something you've always wanted to do? Like, where did you kind of get your start, you know, starting these companies in the health tech space?
Yeah, that actually sounds kind of bad. You're a serial entrepreneur, but well, you know, I was in academics for a long time. So I was a professor in academics in the medical schools. And, you know, I think it was in the early 90s, I realized, I'm a scientist by training, that I could do other things. And actually, I was lucky because my wife told me that if you want to do it, then go ahead and do it. And so I started my first company. I think I was over 50 years old at that point in 2004 in Houston. So I wasn't in academics any longer. And I said, I'd like to do this. And she says, go ahead and do it. And so I did it. So it was kind of a accidental entrepreneur, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah. And then where did you go from there? Now you're up to having founded six companies, right?
Yeah, six companies in Houston. So, you know, what was really good. And I started actually, I remember when I started this, I had actually worked at St. Luke's Hospital in Houston. And they said, well, Kim, you know science and you know some medicine and you know some business. We do about 90,000 catheterizations a year. And we needed to, they needed to actually get the process sort of streamlined because it, you know, that's kind of a lot of catheterizations. And what I noticed there is that most of the people that came in for catheterizations had diabetes. A lot of them had diabetes. And I said, this is not the way it should be. You know, people who have diabetes should be actually treated and have the services available to them. Before they get to the stage of having to have a procedure like having a catheterization and all that type of stuff. So I asked my wife, who's at Texas Children's, Dr. Caravita, Lefke Caravita, and I said, look, you know, let's start a diabetes center. This is what we need to do. And that was it. We were off to the races, actually. It was fun. I have to tell you, it was exhilarating because we were creating something new. It was scary because we were creating something new. And to be honest with you, I'm not sure I really knew what I was doing because it was all new. We started it. We started out at SciFair. It was a very sort of encouraging environment. And so that was it. That's how I began in 2004. I guess after that, in 2008, we really developed the company in diabetes to be able to virtualize and use digital care to serve large employers, and that was Livongo, which went public in 2019. But it was a good journey. I have to tell you one thing, and so I'll tell you when we started. It was interesting in Houston because Houston although it has a huge medical center, it wasn't exactly in 2004 as what you would call an entrepreneur's paradise, right? But it's an environment still exists today, and I'm sure you have insights into this, that really respects actually starting something new and just going after it, just doing it. And I like that. You know, I mean, it was, there were a lot of people who just, you know, said, let's just do it. And they didn't know much about medicine. They didn't know much, you know, things, but it was a very, very entrepreneurial spirit, incredibly.
Yeah. Well, fast forward to almost now 20 years later, you're still founding companies. Your newest endeavor is FemTech Health. So tell me about where that idea came from, and a little bit about the tech aspect of FemTech Health.
Yeah, well, so we founded. I started this company in 2020. So a little bit of the odyssey. The odyssey was when we had our diabetes centers. They were bricks and sticks. I mean, we had to put them up. We put them all up around the city, and because diabetes was a large problem. I give special credit to a lot of the people who. And a lot of the companies in Houston that wanted to pioneer in developing some new model of healthcare. And Houston Independent School District is one of them. And they were way, way ahead of the curve. And so we picked a problem that actually impacted their employees. People who had diabetes, struggled at work. It was a high cost that really, it was hard for them in the work environment because they really didn't have access to care. So we worked really well with some of the very large employers, and Houston Independent School District was one of the first ones who actually was an early adopter. Anyway, to fast forward on that is I noticed the problem of women's health, and here's what the problem is. The problem is that there are a lot of little companies that have actually sprung up to deal with women's health, a little bit in, let's say, the fertility area, a little bit in sort of pregnancy, a little bit in maternity care, a little bit in menopause. And companies or organizations like Houston Independent School District or even some of the other companies, they're not in the business of healthcare. I mean, they can't put together a women's health program by patching together and putting all these little tiny solutions together. So that's a big problem. So therefore, what happens is that, women and women's health is really super important because they're really the key decision makers. Women don't really have a program that's designed for them. It's just sort of a carryover for men. So we embarked in terms of building a platform and building a company where it would be a single destination for a woman, right? She wouldn't have to go to 10 different places to be able to get the care. And so that it wasn't just age specific. Here we got care for 40 plus. Here we got, care for people who want to get pregnant. We built it around journeys, and so a woman could go and have any of these journeys irrespective of her age. So it's really super exciting. It's a continuous platform. It's coordinated. It helps employers not having to be in the business of healthcare. And it serves a great purpose so that we're a single destination. And so I'm super proud of the group that we have that's put this program together. And it's met a very large unmet need. And I'm glad we started in Houston. I mean, we had an opportunity to go in a lot of different places. My last company, Livongo, was in Silicon Valley. And the one before that, the one after that was in Chicago. We moved into Chicago, but I'm not moving anywhere. It's a Houston-based company to provide the services that women need. So that's kind of how we got into it.
I like this idea that, a big challenge with women's health is, there are little businesses and technologies that help with different aspects, and this is going to be more of a comprehensive approach, which makes sense because, some of the first things you did, especially in your stealth mode, was acquire, make some key acquisitions. So tell me a little bit about that process and what that set FemTech Health up to do.
Well, what I really was looking for is to be able to have this sort of comprehensive program. And so we did build the platform. We can either build or buy. And we took a sort of a combined strategy of buying some in particular areas. So for example, we acquired Birchbox for these reasons. We acquired it because it's a large community. It's been existed for 7-8 years, even though it's in the beauty industry, which provides something additional for us. It's a community of a couple hundred thousand very engaged women. Another company we acquired is a company that has a very large social media presence of 1.3 million women who are actually talking and discussing on Facebook on a daily basis. Again, it's a community of very highly engaged women. So we wanted communities that we could serve who were interested but had unmet needs, number one. And number two, Birchbox gave us an opportunity to also think about how do we, you know, transform the beauty industry into a health industry. And it's been incredible. I've learned a lot about the beauty industry. As a guy, I'm absolutely dumbfounded on, I just can't believe how women go, you know, to these shops and other things. They're just bombarded with so much stuff. But we really wanted to be able to transform that industry into just, but you know, beyond buying products, but, you know, buying products that are good for you and that actually work, right? And they make you feel good. So the acquisitions provide us a new channel, a new way of looking at healthcare, and communities of engaged women, which we're now trying to help on the health and wellness area.
I think the beauty industry is really interesting because when there are so many options, we just, as consumers, want more information. Like, we want to know how to decide between the like thousands of lipstick colors or something, you know what I mean? We want to know which one's, you know, cruelty free and everything. Like, I think that's the real challenge, is not more options, but more information about those options and the best way to get that information and make those decisions. And so it's definitely an overwhelming industry.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, skincare is one of those, it's kind of a fuzzy business. I mean, the question is that, how do you know which ones are going to work for your particular type of balance? I mean, you know, skin goes up and down or changes with hormones, right? But so it's not just everyone. And so to make women, I'm going to say make women purchase things to try them, it just makes me, I find it very difficult to believe. So why don't we find out what women would like? Why don't we find out what their biology likes? And why don't we actually give them products that we think match their biology, that work?
Yeah, so that's, you know, exactly what you're trying to do. So tell me a little bit about the platform, the technology, the analytics aspect that you're working on, and the potential there.
Well, so the way that we've built this, and the technology, the way that we've built this is, again, we built the platform not to focus on ages. A lot of people do that, you know, they say 40 plus or menopausal. We don't want to define women by the age. We don't want to define them by the state of menopause or IVF or fertility. So we built journeys, and I'll tell you how the technology interfaces to that. So we have a journey for vaginal and urinary health. We have one for reproductive health. We have one for sexual wellness. We have one for hormone balance, and we have one for beauty, for example. And women can go in between those, of course, right? And they're not age, you know, specific. So for example, the hormone balance could actually be a journey that a woman in menopause or perimenopause could take, but it also could be one in adolescence, right? Whether it's irregular periods or whether it's just, you know, could be acne, it could be a variety of different things. So we built them around the journey so that women could actually go in between. But then the technology and the services, the tools that we use, underlie each of these types of journeys. So, for example, on, let's say, a menopause journey, if you will, or hormonal balance, we've developed diagnostic tests that are at home that will first allow us to find out where the hormones and the hormone balances are. And then after that, we've got other sort of technologies that can support, you know, if the hormonal balance is X, what can we do to either restore it, and what sort of interventions, whether they're clinical interventions, whether they're supplement interventions, whether there's all types of interventions to do that. And that relies on data and technology. So we need to know about the biology of the woman. We need to know the diagnostics.
we need to know actually some of her medical history and things so that we can actually intervene and provide products that are going to relieve her of some of those symptoms, let's say hot flashes, things like that. The other part of the technology is one that's probably more on the B2B side. And it's really probably a bigger concern. It's a concern not only in the economics, but it's a concern for certainly a big concern for women. And here's one, let's say for in vitro fertilization, fertility, for failure. For an employer, by the way, because we work with employers, it's a big ticket cost. It's about $40,000 to go through the course. But, you know, that's just the economics. When you think about the impact for the woman, it's much larger, of course. But you can't fail that too many times because it then becomes a very high ticket, $100,000, $150,000. In addition, if, you know, someone fails twice or three times, it's pretty hard emotionally. It's pretty hard on the psyche. It's pretty hard mentally when there are three failures. So what we've done is done a lot of analytics and take a lot of data. Right now, we're analyzing data from 44 million women over six-year period. It's a big number. To find out, you know, the types of services claims. It's medical claims data. And we're using the technology, using predictive analytics to find out, gee, what are some of the digital markers or biomarkers, if you will, that can be identified in the profile of these women that would indicate they have a high probability of failure? And how far back can you go? So right now, we can go as far back as 2 years, and we've identified some of those markers. So if you know them, then you can actually intervene, right, to try to correct it, to alter the fact that they don't fail. So it saves both the cost, but it also saves the emotional and other trauma, essentially, of failure and repeated failure. So we're using data and technology to be able to enhance both the cost and the well-being of a woman. So that's just one example.
So when you launched, because you initially started in stealth mode, but when Fintech Health announced itself as a company, you already had these acquisitions under your belt. You already had a team, I think, of over 100 employees, right?
Yes.
Right. How have you grown, you know, since this, since you came out of stealth mode, and how are you growing still?
Yeah. So thank you for that question. We've really grown quite rapidly. So we did acquire a number of people. We're about 180 people now. So I won't say that we've doubled since October, but or September. We've grown really. I mean, we've added people, a lot of people on the data analytics, and we've added people on the clinical side. And so we've grown both in sort of revenue as well. We've grown in sort of breadth of services that we offer, and we're also in the process right now of just finalizing two more acquisitions that will, which will actually provide some additional services that we haven't built in internally. So that'll take us up to about 200 people, and increase our revenues considerably now.
And your employees are all over the place. How much are you growing in Houston? How many employees do you have here in Houston?
I'm not sure I could give you the exact number in Houston. You know, with COVID, everybody kind of, even though they might be Houston, some of them just moved away for a while and they'll come back. So I can tell you we're distributed in a lot of different places. We're distributed in Houston. We have a large office in New York. We have an operation in London. We have an operation in Barcelona. We have an operation in Athens, Greece. We have an operation in Shanghai, China, right now. And we actually have a team in San Diego as well. So I think just like a lot of digital health and tech companies, you know, we're working remotely, I think, as well. So in Houston, we have a laboratory. We've set up a laboratory. It's going to grow. And that laboratory is going to do some diagnostic testing and other types of testing. And so it will be a headquarters for some time, and we'll grow the more scientific and clinical stuff. at Houston.
So it definitely seems like you have a multi-tiered approach. You know, you have direct-to-consumer aspect, like reaching consumers. You have through employers. So how do you see this evolving and growing? Do you plan to maintain this variation in your business strategy as FemTech Health grows?
Yeah, you know, I think, so I've come from the space of the business to business. And this is a little bit different. I mean, if you take a disease or a condition, I should say, like diabetes, you know, it's a condition that people have to manage with a lot of different services and things. So, and there's really very little consumer input into that. I mean, the only consumer input is buying supplies, really. There's just not much. In this particular case, the women's health and health products, there's a large consumer demand, number one. Number two, I think more and more with all of these sort of high deductible health plans, people are having to reach into their pocket to pay for services that they want immediately. I mean, think of telehealth. We have a service, and I've used services where, guess what? If you need an antibiotic or you need to speak with a doctor, you can dial it up at any time in our services. If you need something, you can dial it up That's an old word, but you know, you can get right on the net, essentially make the appointment and someone will appear within 10 or 15 minutes. And if it's a simple diagnostics, then what happens is that you get the script written and either you can go pick it up at your local pharmacy or it comes the next day, essentially, to your door. So in any case, it's access and simplifying things like that. So there's a great deal of direct to consumer. On the B2B in women's health, this is also an interesting fact, is that women are leaving the workplace right now. The demands are just too great. They've had to deal with families and things. And I can tell you, I just can't understand how they do it all, to be honest with you, with families and caretaking. But employers now realize to be able to retain women in the workforce. And think about HISD or think about school districts where there are largely women teachers. They have to have a mechanism to retain them. And they also want to lower the costs so that they don't want them to be absent from work and things like that. So the B2B strategy is important because it provides a benefit to the employee and it provides a benefit to the employer. Secondly, this is really also something new for us, and I think that we've created. Think about the idea that if you're in a health plan and you're an employee, you generally think that you're going to get medical care or clinical care. But what if you got skin products, by the way? What if you got supplements? What if you got other sort of beauty products as part of your health benefit? And that's what we're trying to do on the B2B side. There shouldn't be any separation on beauty products, skin products that go along with your health. And so it's kind of a D2C within that B2B as well. So there are two models.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting time for healthcare. I think a lot of people, not just women, are taking more control over the decisions of, you know, their health and wanting to access that information. You know, what else is happening within the greater fintech industry that you're seeing as a really good opportunity, obviously, to start in this space? What's changed that, you know, now is a good time to go into fintech as an entrepreneur?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's a couple of things. This is, I think there's the recognition that technology has been used in healthcare. Okay, so that's part of it. Technology is now being used more and more in healthcare, but the technology is being applied to things that really are characteristically men's healthcare. And then taking that and saying, oh, now we're going to do women's healthcare. So that's kind of number one. Number two, I think now they're saying, well, technology can be used now for things that are really women-centric, like fertility care or, you know, other types of things. So technology, I think they're just beginning to realize now that on women's specific physiology or conditions, you can actually now start to apply very unique sort of technologies. So I think there's just a realization that at least some, that there really are indeed, and it sounds crazy, really indeed different physiologies, and they need different technologies, and they just need different approaches. And so we're seeing a lot of stuff in the menopause area. I've seen a lot of stuff in the fertility area. And so I think there's some quite innovative and unique uses of technology in those areas.
Are there specific trends within the fintech industry that you anticipate only growing or further developing in the next, you know, 5-10 years? What do you have your eyes on specifically within that space?
You're talking about me and our company, Femtech?
Honestly, both the industry as a whole and how that plays into your company.
Well, right now, again, this is my opinion. There's been a sprouting of a lot of companies in very small little segments. And to be honest with you, I think a lot of them are applying technologies that are pretty similar and not exactly what I would call sort of cutting edge technologies. I mean, they're apps. Let's say there's just a lot of apps. I'm not sure what's unique about an app, to be honest with you, or a period tracking app. I don't understand that because it's kind of just simple technology. I think if we get beyond that, I think there's some companies out there that are using some really quite innovative technologies to be able to address some important problems. Well, infertility is a good one, and it's not a tracking app. And I think fertility is a good one. The menopause ones again are kind of centered around hot flashes and things like that, including even some devices that I've seen that are armbands that'll cool you. And so I think we're going to get past that phase. I think that's kind of gimmicky. I think we need to address the real pain points and address the real sort of physiology with some of those solutions. So I think some of it's going to shake out. I hate to say that, but I think some of it's going to shake out because there's so many apps. For us, I'm actually looking outside of what I would call the femtech area to bring in sort of new technologies that address sort of the uniqueness of women's biology. I keep on using biology, but I mean, I think you need to think about the distinct things. I mean, it's all the way to skin, hair, nails. I mean, all the physical features, but, you know, I mean, we're just totally built differently. And all the services. And so I'm looking outside of the femtech area right now to see what can we bring in that is going to actually be able to address the unique biology.
Okay, so one thing I definitely wanted to talk to you about is Houston as a whole, and just to kind of wrap up our conversation today, since you have been an entrepreneur in Houston for probably, I'm willing to bet, a lot longer than a lot of entrepreneurs in Houston. So tell me a bit about how you've seen the Houston innovation and entrepreneurship ecosystem develop, and what difference it's going to make for, you know, these newer entrepreneurs, either new to Houston or new to, you know, start their companies.
Yeah, it's a great question. So I'll give you a little history, and then I'll tell you where I think it's going, and I think it's going in a great place. Great place. You know what happened in the very beginning, and I was involved in this also in the beginning. We thought in Houston that we had such an incredible medical center that all the innovation would come out of, at least the healthcare would come out of the medical center, right? So, you know, everybody was going around the tech transfer offices of, you know, Baylor, MD Anderson, Rice, UT, you know, all of those academic institutions, U of H, hunting for laboratory scientists, right? And things that they could actually bring to the market. Well, having been a laboratory scientist, there is absolutely no connection on how you can make anything commercial. Very little, very, very little. So they were really looking in the wrong places because they were actually facing it what technology can we actually bring and commercialize rather than who are we bringing along to promote, right? What sort of culture, what sort of mentality of an entrepreneur? And most of the people in academics are not entrepreneurial. They choose academics to publish papers instead of, you know, it being a laboratory. So I think fundamentally, we you know, Houston kind of missed the boat in the very beginning because we were focused too much on the academic institutions and thought that we could extract novel ideas and entrepreneurs from that. And that didn't work. Only when we started to see a couple of companies come out of the Houston entrepreneur or the innovation did other entrepreneurs actually sort of emerge. Oh, I can start a company. I can do this. And the beauty about being in Houston, as I told you in the beginning, it's not, I would say, wildcatter. It's very supportive of doing things not like everybody else does, you know? And I found that. And people are willing to take a risk. I don't care whether it's in healthcare or whether it's in oil. So there was an underlying entrepreneurial spirit in the community, not in the academic centers, where entrepreneurs actually had a chance and they were given a chance by the community that was the risk taker. So we were looking the wrong places in the beginning. And then I think if you take a look at really who lives in Houston and what Houston is like, there are a lot of risk takers, a lot of risk takers. They're willing to do a lot of different things. There are a lot of investors who are willing to invest on a lot of different things, even if they don't know about them. So it's very entrepreneurial. It's not calculated entrepreneurship. It's very, it's just a very high, you know, risk taker promotion of entrepreneurs. So it's a great place, by the way. People don't get that about Houston. It's a great place to start a business. You know, they think they go to Austin and things like that or Silicon Valley. And it's a completely different environment. The last thing I'll say about the entrepreneurial culture in Houston, it's a lot more down to earth. I have experience in the Silicon Valley area. It's not flashy at all. It's just, let's just get it done. There's no flash and fanfare and stuff like that. And, you know, it's let's just do the job.
When you think of, you know, I love hearing these positives, and I think they really resonate probably with anyone who's listening that has any experience in this space, the culture of, you know, being down to earth and risk taking. I think that's very true. What do you feel like Houston still needs to be able to claim its status as an innovative city? You know, what's on our to-do list still, either in health tech or more broadly?
Well, that's also a good question. And here's what I think. Originally, you would say, oh, it would be an influx of venture capitalists that would come in because venture capital is polarized. It's either West Coast or East Coast. Now it's a lot more Austin and some in Chicago. So I would have said venture capital, but I don't think it's that. I think it's a couple of big hits and big wins, number one. But I also got to tell you that very different than Silicon Valley or the Chicago. People don't make a big deal. I mean, look, when we went public, when Livongo, when we started our diabetes, we went public. I mean, that was a $3.5 billion. I mean, this was a company that started in Houston. And it started in Houston, and then we were bought, you know, it was bought for $18.5 billion in 2020, I think it was. It was just kind of, oh, okay, well, you know, it started in Houston, no big deal. But there are a lot of really good companies that started in Houston, and they're not being pushed by the media and stuff. I don't mean that's a fault, but it's really a different thing. Well, yeah, okay. It was a Houston company. It did well. It served a lot of people. It, you know, it's a $1 billion company, but they, you know, they don't advertise a whole lot. So I think, I think what you're doing is great. And I think what we need to do is we need to actually publicize it that, oh, okay, we're in Texas. We're in Houston. We're not in San Francisco or Palo Alto, and we're not in Boston, but, you know, darn it, we're, we've got a lot of great entrepreneurs, and there are a lot of great companies, and here are the companies that are a lot of great companies. You know, here are the great companies. So I think we just need to push, and we need to advertise a little bit more that this is not, it's not what the West Coast would and the East Coast would perceive as a wasteland, by no means.
Absolutely. Well, definitely.
So keep on doing what you're doing.
Well, I will. I for sure will. Well, and I think that there's that is absolutely true that Houston needs some big wins under its belt, and to know about those big wins and let that inspire local entrepreneurs, but also, you know, get the word out that to other markets that things are happening in Houston. So I think a lot of people would echo that sentiment for sure. Well, I really appreciate you taking your time today to talk to me. This is great to catch up and really see what you're trying to do in this space with your company. So I appreciate the time.
Thanks, Natalie. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Houston Innovators Podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss next week's edition, and check out innovationmap.com for the latest Houston startup and innovation news.